Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
This is Deborah Kelso. Today we're very pleased to have two fine guests joining us, Betsy Carlson from the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and Dr. Fred Sharp. Welcome to you both.
Hey, y'all. Great to be here.
Hi there.
Longtime listeners of Nature Now will know Fred from several shows that he has graciously joined us on, speaking on a variety of topics, anything from bird song to prairie ecology. But his main work for the past few decades has been on humpback whale research with the Alaska Whale Foundation. And he will be speaking with us wearing that hat today. And Betsy has been working for several years with the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, helping to coordinate their community science projects. And she and Fred have both been very active in protecting marine mammals, both through their involvement with education and with the Marine Mammal Stranding and Disentanglement Networks. And we thought that this would be a great time to speak about this issue before the most active time of boating and crabbing and seal pupping season when people are out and about. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? This was Fred's choice for mystery sound, and he will reveal its source and tell us more about it at the end of the program. So there was a recent workshop sponsored by the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Most of you know it by NOAA, on marine mammal health in our part of the Salish Sea, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was jointly sponsored by Cascadia Research Collective based in Olympia and SR3. That stands for Sea Life Response, Rehabilitation, and Research. It's a new organization. They're based in Des Moines, and they have an interest in helping us study and rehabilitate mammals. We don't have a facility that we can actually take injured, sick or injured marine mammals to. And so the whole idea of SR3 is to remedy that. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Because we have the closest place other than that before was where?
There's developing resources at the Newport Marine Aquarium in Central Oregon. And then after that, the next place is down at the Marine Mammal Lab in Sausalito, the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California.
Oh, so that's a long way away.
Also, Paws is a place we can take seal pups, but they don't have a lot of capacity. And there's another place, Wolf Hollow, I believe, up in the San Juan Islands, that will also take smaller pinnipeds, but, you know, it's mostly smaller animals and not larger animals. And I think that's where SO3 can increase the capacity of caring for some of the marine mammals in this area.
Yeah, that's great. So did that workshop cover all marine mammals or focus on whale populations?
I was focusing on cetaceans, primarily humpbacks, grays, and orca, but we also covered some stuff with seals and sea lions.
Uh-huh. So what were the primary issues that they covered?
Well, we were interested, a lot of it was disentanglement. Disentanglement's a problem where animals wander into fishing gear, lines, ropes, nets, crab pots. And so really we're all concerned about response readiness. And a big part is making sure that the public knows the hotlines to contact, who to contact, and from what districts. And we talked a lot about best practices, how to approach animals safely, and training, and we talked about new tools and technologies, especially satellite tracking systems. And also there was a lot of discussion about the gray whale's unusual mortality event, which I know we'll get to in a little bit.
Yeah. Betsy, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center is the go-to place locally to send information on marine mammal strandings. Is that right?
That's right. So we work with a number of volunteers in this area. We cover East Jefferson County, so we are the East Jefferson County Marine Mammal Stranding Network. And the zones that we cover go from just south of Dungeness Spit, following the shoreline all the way around to Brennan, so the Coyle Peninsula, Port Ludlow, Maristone Island, and it's a pretty big area.
Yeah, it is a big area when you consider all the coastline along there. So do you get calls like all year long, or do they peak in early summer, or what's the...
There's a fascinating correlation between the number of calls we get and how nice the weather is out here. So
you've been getting lots of calls this week.
Well, actually, the pupping, our biggest, most frequent visitor for our Marine Mammal Stranding Network call line is for people who have found harbor seal pups. And the pupping season starts eastern Straits of Juan de Fuca in June, and it runs for a few months from then. And then, because we also cover part of the Hood Canal, that pupping season tends to be later in the summer, August through October. And so we could get pup calls anytime from June through October.
Uh-huh. And yeah. Then other species, like do you get calls on people seeing whales out there?
Oh, yeah. We've had a couple of incidents of stranded gray whales, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit more. Harbor porpoises are other frequent flyers, so to speak, for marine mammal calls. The number of harbor porpoises in the area is actually increasing compared to what it used to be.
Oh, that's good news.
Yeah, at least, well, and compared to the number of dolls porpoises, of which there are not as many as there used to be, or apparently aren't. So we'll get, and then California sea lions, Stellar sea lions, they come in as well, and so sometimes we get calls for them.
Yeah, but how about the Stellar sea cow? Oh, that's extinct.
Only in April. Only in April.
What about the Loch Ness Monster? Didn't you have
Oh, one of the fun ones is when we get calls for the northern elephant seal, which are the biggest pinnipeds around here, and they catastrophically molt. So their whole outer epidermis falls off, and it just looks horrible. It looks like they've been beaten up. And no, it's a normal process. And they'll haul out on somebody's beach, and they just look just ragged, and they're not happy, and that's just what they do. So be grateful you're not a northern elephant seal and lose your epidermis every year.
Yeah. So how long does it take them to regrow that hair? I mean, are they on the beach for a while?
Like a week or so. So several days.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Enough time for lots of people to see them and go, it's got mange, it's something wrong.
It's hurt, it's been wounded, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what I would probably think about.
Yeah. Yeah. When we talk about readiness, this means helping animals entangled in nets also. I mean, it means helping animals that are stranded and also those entangled in nets.
That's right.
And Fred, you've had quite a bit of experience with whale disentanglements up in Alaska. Do you want to review for us what this protocol involves?
Yeah, well, we're very fortunate that we have these hotlines, and often many of our calls come from the general public. And usually when we get a call, the first thing we want to do is try to get additional eyes out there on the water to assess the severity of the entanglement. And a big concern is if the animal, is actually life-threatening? Is this the animal going to perish without intervention? And if that's the case, what we try to do is get a rapid team out on the water, even in advance of necessarily our disentanglement tools and the more highly trained personnel. If we can just get some trained eyes out on the water to just do a quick assessment and let us know the severity, the general direction of the animals traveling, get a standby boat in position so when we get out there on the water with the main set of tools, we'll be able to find the animal. And once we, if we do decide the animal's a candidate for intervention, typically what we'll do is just do more quick assessment, just like approach the animal carefully so not to alarm it. Sometimes we'll actually attach additional gear onto the entangling lines or nets. If the animal's moving too quickly, we want to slow it down, get it relaxed, get it going slow enough or halting its forward progress so we can get a good look at it and find out how the animal's entangled. Is there lines going through the mouth? Is there tail stalks? Is there lines cutting into the animal? And using drones, which are a fantastic tool, and GoPros on a long pole, we can kind of do a whole body assessment and find out how we want to go about, which lines we want to cut first. Usually we start from the head from the mouth area and move back, cutting the lines. And usually the last cut is around the tailstock because the animal, for the most part, starting to get released, they want to get going. And we also try to get photo IDs. And if we can get a good image, we can actually upload it into Happy Whale. You're familiar with Happy Whale, Betsy?
Well, so Happy Whale is one organization that is out there that is collecting images for, at least I know, for humpbacks. And then Orca Network in our area is also very interested in knowing what whales are out there. They track them, they report to NOAA and let them know if there's concerns about the health of the gray whales or whatever whales are out there. And they really keep a good eye on the different animals.
A lot of people know how unusual the markings are for the orca and how they know each of the individuals. But humpbacks have amazing diagnostic characteristics too, right? I mean,
that big underneath of their flipper, underneath their tail flip, just like a big billboard, 15 feet across and 5 feet wide. And they have a unique pattern of pigmentation and scarring on the underside of each of the tails. And so by getting a mugshot of those, we can put them into these local, national, international databases. And, you know, sometimes if we have an animal that we know is entangled, but we've lost it, but we know it's still out there in the system, we can go back through the individual sighting history and come up with a, you know, general idea of where it likes to feed and move and, you know, local migratory corridors with a greater chance of hopefully intercepting the animal in distress.
Uh-huh. And you would put tags on them too, so that you can relocate them if they get away.
That's
right?
That's right. In fact, oftentimes when we send out this advanced team, they will have a satellite tag with them. And the tag just gets clipped on to the pre-existing trailing gear on the animal. And now we've bought ourselves some time. Instead of like having to try to get a response team there that afternoon before it gets dark, because frequently we lose animals overnight, by getting a satellite tag on the animal, now we can track it over time and space for hours, days, and even weeks. And that allows us to mount a much more competent response.
And I guess we need to reiterate how important it is that just concerned boaters don't try to jump in and disentangle whales themselves.
That's
right?
Absolutely right. You know, you can actually make it worse. You can actually, if we're certainly endanger yourselves by getting too near an animal without the appropriate training and tools. And what happens is, you know, sometimes, and it's very unfortunate, is that some well-meaning good Samaritans will go out there and they'll see a towing buoy and they'll just go up and just cut it off, right? But that leaves all of the most lethal portion of the entanglement still in the mouth where around the flippers and flukes where it can cut into the animals, cause infections, prevent feeding, and even a potential mortality. So it's really important that public, give these animals their space, and just like you would any emergency responders for enforcement or for fire or life-saving, get the trained personnel on the scene. And the best thing you can do is report immediately what you see if you see an animal in distress, if it's in the shallow water or looks like it's got entangling gear on them or anything that would cause you concern. You know, we're there. Please call one of the hotline numbers. And but stay away from the animal. You know, the regulatory framework is 100 yards, 200 yards for orcas in Puget Sound. But within those constraints, we, you know, please try to get photographs and send those along with your initial report. And also another really important way the public can help is just by standing by. If you do see an animal that's you're concerned about, you can rearrange your schedule for that afternoon and just stand by or hand off the animal to another vessel in the vicinity until responders can get there. It will greatly increase the opportunity that we can recite that individual.
Uh-huh. And the same with you, right, Betsy? There are watchers on the beach if a seal pup is found so that, you know, dogs don't come upon it or people don't reach up and touch it. I mean, if people see a seal pup on the beach, what is the protocol there?
The best thing to do for the seal pup is, especially the young harbor seal pups that we see around here coming up in June and the summer, is to give them space because mom has placed the seal pup there and she's gone off to go find some food and she'll be back to get the seal pup, but she won't return if there are people or pets nearby, and that will scare her off. it's hard to see a little one, and I know people mean the most and mean the best and really want to get out there and take care of them, but the best thing to do is keep yourself away and keep your pets away and give it some space so mom will come back and get and pick up the pup. And if it's been there for a couple of days, then definitely call it in. You can call it in if you see it, and that's fine, but you want to call it in. The other thing to keep in mind is marine mammals do carry diseases that are transmittable to other mammals like yourself or dogs. So you definitely don't want to touch them and get close.
Yeah. But back to gray whales, this is one of the best times of the year to see gray whales in our area, right? Are most of the whales we see moving north from where they've spent the winter in Baja, California? And will they stay with us, or will they continue north to Alaska?
Well, the gray whales are on their way at this time of year. They're heading back north up to Alaska to where they will feed for the summer and fatten up. And we have a small group of grays that come in and feed off of the coast of Whidbey Island and by Everett, at the mouth of the Snohomish River in that area. And it's really pretty cool because they've found this ghost shrimp resource, and they'll go down to the bottom and get a big old mouthful of mud and shrimp and other things that could be lying around on the bottom of the water around here, like, you know, beer bottles and sweatpants and things like that.
Well, but, and it's amazingly shallow. I mean, sometimes they're in amazingly shallow water, right?
Yes. So that's why one of the theories is that the female sounders don't come back into these waters, because it is, if they have had a pup or calf, I mean, if they are bringing a little one along with them back up to Alaska, they don't want to risk the problem of feeding in such shallow waters, because it is pretty tricky. You know, you're a large animal and you're feeding in hardly any water. But one of the coolest things, I think, is that you can see the whale tracks from space. If you look at Google Earth and you look in the sand, you know, in certain times of year along the side of Whidbey Island, you can see these big divots in the sand, and that's a whale track.
You were telling us about that earlier, and I just couldn't believe it. I meant to get on straight away and look. I mean, that's just astonishing. I love that.
So look around May 2016. There's a way to adjust your time bar on Google Earth, and you can sort of go back in time and zoom in there sort of halfway up the eastern side of the island. It's pretty cool. And you can see it elsewhere, too. You just, once you know what to look for, then look for low tide shots from space.
Oh, that's so great. We are going to pick up this fascinating conversation next month. So thank you so much, Fred and Betsy, for joining us. And we will see you and hear more about gray whales next month.
Awesome.
All right.
Great. Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. Thank you.
And here's our mystery sound again. Oh, that is just such an outrageous sound. It's what is described as a throp call from a humpback whale, and it's a sound that Fred recently recorded under his research permit number 19703 with the Alaska Whale Foundation. So would you like to tell us more about this great sound, Fred?
Yeah, well, it's such a pleasure to work with humpback whales, as they're extremely diverse vocalists, and you know, they probably ushered in the era of modern marine conservation by the discovery in the late 60s that humpback whales sing these amazing songs. And they also, when they leave the breeding areas and come up to the northern temperate cool areas like along our waters, they still have a lot of different sounds that they make. One of them is called their social sounds. That's kind of like a conversational jabber that the whales give. And this throp call is part of that lexicon of social sounds. And throp calls are known worldwide from humpback whales. They've been reported in all populations where we've sampled, and both on the breeding, feeding, and migratory corridors. And these throp calls, you know, they're a super common call. They probably account for maybe 20% of all the sonic energy that comes out of a humpback is a throp or a throp-like call. Depending on where you are in the southern hemisphere, they're called wump calls and wop calls, and they get described in different areas because they have slightly different nuances, but they're all part
dialects.
Yeah, exactly, different dialects. Yeah. But they're all a part of this what we call these a broad frequency modulated staccato upsweep, which is this family of throp calls, and we think there might be like contact calls in a bird flock when they come percolating through the forest in your yard. You
can keep in
keeping contact, keeping some cohesion. Humpback whales, they're really diverse socially, and it just seems like if you're just listening with the hydrophone to these dispersed whales out there, about every 5 or 10 minutes you'll hear one of these throp, throp. Sometimes they come in little bouts, they get a little bit chattery, and it's very likely
males and females.
Yeah, it appears that all members of the population, including calves, gives these throp calls. And it's been speculated by some of my colleagues, Lauren Wild and Christina Gabriel. They've studied these throp calls in Glacier Bay, and they noticed that these calls appear to be out there. They're not light dependent. They're day and night. They're occurring as these background sounds. And humpbacks at certain times they really want to get together and feed in large groups. Other times they're much more dispersed. And so by just letting people know where you're at, at different times you can prevent other whales from coming over if the food resources are limited, that everybody wants to stay spread out. But if things are really locally aggregated and abundant, maybe these throp calls help them recognize who's in the area. And there's probably individual signature information, just like a human voice within these calls, that they can recognize each other. They may certainly have additional information content or referential signals that we haven't yet deciphered, but they're important calls because they're so abundant. And of course, there's always a concern nowadays, except in the time of COVID, but about ship noise, right? The oceans have gotten actually quite a bit quieter the last year or so because there's a lot fewer ships out plying the oceans, particularly cruise ships, and even a slowdown in global shipping traffic. And so that's been kind of good for the whales and actually kind of provided a neat control to study these throp calls under different regimes of anthropogenic noise. But because they are so common, they're a concern that masking by human sounds would diminish their ability to transmit over, mid to longer range distances.
Because those calls you can hear them underwater a long way.
Yeah,
right?
they can travel for considerable distances underwater, absolutely. And
by considerable distance, how far?
Oh, I would say a couple of miles easily. Yeah, and on good days with certain acoustic lensing or acoustic conductivity down at lower depths, it could probably be 10 or 15, maybe even 20 miles.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so part of our work is actually we've been doing some playbacks of these sounds to the whales to see how they respond. And this is my work with my colleague Michelle Fournet at Oregon State University and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And what we've been able to find is that by playing back these sounds to dispersed whales, it can actually elicit them to call back, which is kind of cool. They don't approach us or anything. They stay out doing their thing, but it's kind of like they're just checking in, like, oh, who's that? What's going on? It's just like, so of the many different sounds that the humpbacks make, we're starting to get an appreciation that the throp calls are sort of their background transponder, sort of background signature sound that they give to help regulate the dispersion of their populations.
Huh. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for that. And thanks very much for coming on the show with us.
Yeah. Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Bye, Fred.
Cool.
All right. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the third week of May. Thanks very much to our guests, Betsy Carlson and Fred Sharp, and to our sound recorder and editor, Nora Petrich, and to all of you for listening. If you would like to listen again, please go to kptz.org and search the Nature Now podcast for show number 516. As always, wishing you happy trails.
Today's closing music is Ocean Dream from the Paul Winter Consort.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.